Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning and welcome to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Peter Mayer's with you. Although Ramona Cavall is here as well. In fact, Ramona is the star of The Book Show today, presenting her recent Overland Lecture in praise of the common reader. Overland, now in its 53rd year, describes itself as the most radical of Australia's long-standing literary cultural magazines. Its catchcry is "Temper democratic, bias Australian," a phrase borrowed from Joseph Furphy to describe his great Australian novel, Such is Life. Although what Furphy actually wrote was "Temper democratic, bias offensively Australian," and I think the Overland editors would be happy with that description as well. In 2001, the editors of Overland launched a lecture series inviting writers and public intellectuals to speak their mind on Australian culture, literature and society. The most recent Overland lecture was delivered last month in Melbourne by ABC Radio National's very own Ramona Cavall, presenter of The Book Show, usually. And we're pleased to be able to bring you that lecture today. Ramona's title is "In Praise of the Common Reader," a term coined by Virginia Woolf. In the lecture, Ramona talks about the importance of stories in our lives and about how reading enables us to experience lots of lives, not just the one we live. You'll learn about the stories that moved Ramona as a girl, the child of Jewish immigrant parents growing up in 1960s Melbourne. And Ramona shares the wisdom and insight she's gleaned from interviewing some of the world's great writers. Here's Ramona Cavall with her Overland Lecture.
I don't usually quote Virginia Woolf, but I found this quote from her, and it really said what I really wanted to say in a longer version. I'll start with this. "The common reader," she says, "differs from the critic and the scholar. He is worse educated, and nature has not gifted him so generously. He reads for his own pleasure rather than to impart knowledge or correct the opinions of others. Above all, he's guided by an instinct to create for himself, out of whatever odds and ends he can come by, some kind of whole, a portrait of a man, a sketch of an age, a theory of the art of writing. He never ceases, as he reads, to run up some rickety and ramshackle fabric which shall give him the temporary satisfaction of looking sufficiently like the real object to allow of affection, laughter and argument." So that's what Virginia Woolf says. In 1995, I interviewed America's brilliant literary essayist, novelist and teacher William Gass. And while his essays were full of civility and light, he had all sorts of awards because of them, he just published this novel called The Tunnel, and it was quite different. It has as its protagonist a guy called William Kohler, who's a man in his 50s, a professor at a Midwestern university. He's just finished his magnum opus, Guilt and Innocence in Hitler's Germany, which has taken him 30 years to write. And Kohler, this character, sits down and writes an introduction, and the introduction is full of bigotry and self-loathing and loathing for humanity. In this introduction, he justifies the Holocaust and his hatred for the victims. It's a really sort of ugly piece of writing. Gass's book is itself designed like a thing that doesn't want to be read. There's a very forbidding cover in red and black and white, reminiscent of a swastika flag, and it's meant to be exactly so. And inside are designs of flags for the party of disappointed people, as he calls them, cartoons, typographical games, anti-Semitic limericks and ditties in bold type. William Gass, the writer, has been a professor of philosophy at Washington University in St. Louis and director of the International Writing Program there. He spent, like his protagonist, 30 years writing this book, The Tunnel, his magnum opus. He said he wanted to make art out of evil, to prove that art has nothing to do with morality. He was interested in this aesthetic challenge of whether or not you could take on some certain kinds of contemporary evil and give it eloquent expression. I asked him how a novel that deals with the Holocaust, with Hitler in the camps, could be self-contained when the events actually happened in the real world, and whether employing these real-world events carries with it some moral responsibility. And he said it was a mistake to suppose that because a book might be in some sense immoral or untrue, it was therefore a bad work of art. And when I asked him about the characters novelists create and whether part of the writer's art is to make the reader care about them as human beings, his response took me back. He says, that's childish. That's to confuse a creation. These are not real people, they're verbal constructs. To imagine they're real is very naive, he said. And when I said to him that most people didn't read like that, he said, well, most people aren't interested in art. They're interested in the world, they're interested in themselves, and the novel has traditionally played on this, and it's a fake. And you're not supposed to read novels and mistake it for life. So he said that in this realistic tradition, though, people read novels to pretend to find out about life, and they're just fooling themselves. So I really had to ask myself, was I really being a child? Was I really reading in a naive way? Now, I haven't been educated in either literature or literary theory, but I knew that Gass represented one end of a spectrum which placed the importance of text and language above character and story. But I had studied science because he said, actually, if you really want to find out about life, you should have a look at science or mathematics. And I had studied science, and I knew that difficult concepts in science are, in fact, regularly conveyed by means of a story of some kind. Maybe that the immune system is like an army, or that the inside of an atom is like a Schrodinger's cat in a box. And all these ideas, these stories, helped human beings understand more about the realities and truths that science pursued. And maybe stories even helped us pose certain kinds of questions that we went on to solve experimentally and theoretically. So I was trying to work out what he means by the childish reading of a story. And then I thought about what childhood was. And we've got this assumption that it's a time of innocence and a time where we play with our toys and our parents provide a warm and supportive home and they gently introduce us to the world around us. And in fact, in America, there are legions of people today who are combing the shelves of public libraries for unsuitable stories that are going to spoil childhoods all over the country. And in fact, this year, top of the American Library Association's annual list of texts about which parents and school officials complained was an award-winning picture book called And Tango Makes Three, which is based on a true story of two male penguins who together hatched an adopted fertilised egg at New York Central Park Zoo. And this is the main book that has been ripped off the shelves as being dangerous for children and corrupting of their childhood. One of the first stories I remember was told to me by my father, who, as it happened, was a Jewish Holocaust survivor from Poland. This is about a woodcutter wandering about in a forest. I imagined it was Poland. I always thought Poland was cold and always snowy, but I went there once and it was summer and there were cornflowers blooming in the fields, although the fields were rye, so maybe they were rye flowers. I'm sure there must be rye flowers and I'm not sure that they're blue, but these flowers were blue. Anyway, in this other story that my father was telling me, there was simply a man, and then he came upon a bird. And my father said he wanted to kill the bird and he wanted to carry the bird home to feed his family. And I remember my father said he grabbed the bird, and I thought that was very, very good. I mean, that was a fantastic, you know, it's hard to catch a bird, isn't it? I mean, I remember being in the gardens across the road from our flat in Beaconsfield Parade in St Kilda, and, you know, imagine grabbing a bird and chasing a bird, and even just the grabbing of the bird made me think of a fantastic scene in my mind. Anyway, maybe he didn't grab the bird because my father was an uneducated Polish tailor. Maybe that wasn't the right word. But anyway, now the bird is in the man's hands, and just before he kills the bird, just before he breaks its neck, it speaks to him. Don't kill me, said the bird. Why not, says the man. Because if you let me live, I'll reward you by telling you three secrets of life. All right, says the man, what are they? One, don't believe what you're told. 2, don't climb higher than you can. And 3, don't reach for things beyond your grasp. And so the man let the bird go, and it flew higher and higher and higher, because there's always 3 highers in these stories, to the top of a very tall tree. And I imagine it was like a Christmas tree. It wasn't like a straggly gum tree or even like one of the palms in Beaconsfield Parade. And so it's at the top of the tree, and now the bird begins to laugh. And really, I suddenly hear it as a very cruel laugh, a jeering laugh. And I hear the voice of the bird now, no longer sweet. Oh, you're such a stupid man. You let me go. But I have a heart that is pure and solid gold. And if you'd killed me, you would have had riches beyond your wildest dreams, and now you have nothing, not even a bird for your dinner. And this made the man very angry. And he realized that he's lost his fortune, and he was so angry he began to climb the tree. And he climbed it to the very top, to the part where the branches get smaller and smaller and harder to hold, and the treetop moves in the wind. And just when he got to the topmost branch and the bird was within his grasp, it flew off and hovered just above his head, and he held out his hand to reach it, and he lost his balance and he toppled over, crashing to the ground, and he was dead. And my father said, the thing was, the man thought he'd lost his fortune, but actually he'd been given 3 secrets of life. He was told not to believe what he was told, and yet he believed the bird about the golden heart, and he was told not to climb higher than he could, and he didn't listen. And he climbed to the top of the tree, and he was told not to reach for things beyond his grasp, and he did, and he fell to his death. And what a strange story. But I liked it, and I remember asking for it to be told again and again, because I was intrigued by this paradox of being advised not to listen to advice. Sort of going round and round and round in my head. It was the opposite of stories about heroic adventures and magic powers and strivings for success, and perhaps just the kind of story that arose in a feudal landscape where no one expected too much and it was best not to make waves. In fact, when I began working in broadcasting, my father said, if you have to speak up, speak nicely, and above all, don't be controversial. It wasn't the first advice of my father that I didn't take. At primary school, they played us the 1944 recording of Oscar Wilde's The Happy Prince, adapted for radio, another story about a bird and a man. But this time, the man was already dead, a statue, and the bird was a swallow resting at his feet. She was on her way to Egypt to join her friends after waiting behind to resolve an impossible love affair with a very unsuitable object. It was a reed, a bit of grass, which is very unsuitable for a bird. I found a recording of this story while I was writing this essay, and I heard again the tones of Orson Welles, and they took me back to the mat at St Kilda Park State School, where we sat on the floor for story time. High above the city, he begins, on a tall column stood the statue of the Happy Prince. He was gilded all over with thin leaves of fine gold. For eyes he had 2 bright sapphires, and a large red ruby glowed on his sword hilt. And the story tells of the prince's awareness after a life of carefree happiness that there were people in the city who were poor and needed help, and how he cried all over the little swallow at his feet. When I was alive and had a human heart, he says, I did not know what tears were, for I lived in the palace of Sanssouci, where sorrow is not allowed to enter. So I lived, and so I died, and now that I am dead, they have set me up here so high that I can see all the ugliness and all the misery of my city, and though my heart is made of lead, yet I cannot choose but weep. Can you imagine how sad these sounds were intoned by Orson Welles? Well, the prince asks the swallow to help him, and slowly the sapphires and the ruby and the leaves of gold are given to the needy of the city, including a writer in a garret who needs to finish a play he's working on. But winter comes and the prince has given everything up, and the swallow has helped so much that she's missed the opportunity to fly with the other swallows to Egypt, and she falls dead at the statue's feet. And somehow the statue is dead again, too, and he's melted down by the burghers of the city because he's no longer beautiful. And the only thing left is his heart of lead. And the story ends like this. What a strange thing, said the overseer of the workmen at the foundry. This broken lead heart will not melt in the furnace. We must throw it away. So they threw it on a dust heap where the dead swallow was also lying. And then Orson says, "Bring me the two most precious things in the city," said God to one of his angels. And the angel brought him the leaden heart and the dead bird. And I still adore this tale of sacrifice and love. And I'm amazed that after all this time it still has the power to move me. And what a very different bird is this sweet swallow from the nasty bird in the Polish forest. But again, this is the paradox of the prince enlisting the swallow to bring happiness to various people in the city while causing the death of the good little bird, because he wouldn't let the bird go to Egypt and it got so cold that the bird died of hunger and being frozen. There were other stories I found equally unforgettable. When I was 9, I read Hans Christian Andersen's 1845 story, The Red Shoes, about the orphan girl called Karen who wanted a pair of red shoes just like the ones she'd seen a princess wear. And she managed to acquire a pair and not only wore them to church, which was already a pretty show-offy thing to do, but worse still, she thought about them when she was taking communion. Of course, she had to be punished for this. An old soldier with a red beard whom she passed outside the church cast a spell, and that was it. She was cursed to dance uncontrollably until she met an executioner, and she was so tired from the out-of-control dancing that she begged him to cut off her feet, which he did, and her feet went on dancing in the red shoes around the countryside. And the story concludes, and he carved her a pair of wooden feet and some crutches and taught her a psalm, which is always sung by sinners. She kissed the hand that guided the axe and went away over the heath. So she went on to become a very pious girl indeed, who was finally allowed back to church, minus her feet. And I can still see the bloody feet in the red shoes dancing and dancing all over the wooded landscape. So never want what princesses have, and if you get it, don't think about it in church, or your feet will have to come off. And you will have to kiss the hand of the man that chops them. Another paradox. The God of forgiveness and do unto others, so unreasonably cruel to a poor girl who was already an orphan just because she loved her red shoes. If childhood is a time of innocence, tales like these were an assault on grace.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National and the Overland Lecture delivered by The Book Show's usual presenter, Ramona Cavall. Her lecture is called In Praise of the Common Reader, and Ramona's taking us through the stories that shaped her childhood in Melbourne in the 1960s.
I think I officially lost my literary innocence on the floor of the Camberwell Bus Library in 1965. I'm not sure if they still have this kind of service in urban centres in Melbourne, but after we moved to the eastern suburbs to our very own house, the bus used to come and park down near the shops. And for immigrant families like mine, whose parents had only been educated to primary school and where their first, second, third, fourth and fifth languages were other than English, for these families the bus was much less daunting than the big main library near the Camberwell Town Hall. Those big places presented problems. They were hard to navigate when you looked different and spoke with an accent. And the bus was a lot easier. There were fewer books and things could be approached on a more human scale. So my mother took my hand and got me registered, and I had a card. I was very proud, and I was shown the books for children and the ones for grown-ups. But I tired of the children's section, and I noticed that as you lay on your belly on the floor of the bus that smelt of lino and rubber, deciding what books you wanted, you could read the spines of the adult section, and there you could read Kafka and Katzenzakis and Kerouac and Koestler. And I learnt there to put things in alphabetical order. And I thought I'd take Kafka's The Trial because it's a very little book. And I took the book up to the librarian. "Please, sir," I said, like Oliver Twist, "could I have this one?" And he said, "That's for adults and you're only in grade 6. But I said I'd read all the interesting ones for kids. And he let me borrow it, and I walked home gravely, the book in my clammy hand. Actually, I hadn't read all the books for kids. C.S. Lewis had passed me by, and Tolkien, and most of Enid Blyton. But I remember reading The Trial, getting the idea that Kafka was writing about some system that was bewildering to his protagonist, and for some reason he was being investigated for something he didn't do. And for me it had echoes of my childhood and of my own general state of bewilderment. And I read the book again when I was older and I understood it more, but I think the bus librarian gave me confidence, and the bus itself was small enough to make me think I had its measure. Actually, in a report, Public Libraries in Australia, in 1947, a guy called Lionel McColvin said of these kinds of services, "Nowhere in the English-speaking world will books have to be taken so far for so few, and nowhere else will they mean so much." So I found myself, in a sense, in pages from these books in this library. I read Christina Stead's The Man Who Loved Children and discovered a girl with a difficult relationship with her father, and knew for the first time that my own experience wasn't an isolated case in a world of good daddies and happy games of being tossed in the air by strong arms. I read My Mother's House and Cedo, the stories by Colette, which gave me a child's eye view of adults in a French provincial village. I followed the tragic life of Flaubert's Madame Bovary, who read too many books and thought reality should be romantic. And I still have an image of her walking over the edge of a cliff, her face pressed close to the book in her hands, which never was in the book, but it's in the way my mind has catalogued her fate, that she just walked off the edge like some person in a cartoon. I actually once followed a man off the edge of a cliff too, because I thought he knew the way. While William Gass implied that childish reading tends towards the simplification of life, I found that I learned adult truths from stories. Perhaps we need to believe that stories are real, need to identify with characters so that they come to life like the statue in The Happy Prince and affect us, paradoxes and all. In 2000, the first Inuit-made film, Atanarjuat, The Fast Runner, was released to wide acclaim, and I don't know whether you saw it, but it warns of the danger of setting personal desire above the needs of the group. Atanarjuat falls for a woman promised to his rival, and he has to flee from the tribe. He runs naked for miles and miles over the ice, and this scene in the film is extraordinary, seemingly shot in real time and bone-chilling. And writer and filmmaker Zacharias Kunuk said he heard the story of Atanarjuat from his mother when he was a child, falling asleep side by side with five brothers and sisters. And he said, "Our father would wake up at the crack of dawn and harness his dog team and go out hunting for our family. And our mother would put us to sleep at night with all these stories about our ancestors, how they lived and what would happen to us if we were like this one or that one when we grew up." And once you get that picture into your head of that naked man running for his life across the ice, his hair flying, you never forget it. Buried were all these lessons we kids were supposed to learn about how if you break these taboos that keep our ancestors alive, you could be out there running for your life just like him. He may have heard the story as a child and listened to it as a child, but he made a film about it as an adult, and we saw it as adults and learned the lesson of the fast runner as we shivered in the cinema. And in our own Western traditions, stories have been told from before the time of the Old Testament and Socrates, asking, how are we to live? What makes a happy life? How is it possible to honour the very souls with which we are blessed? I have a friend who's an extremely observant Jew, and we've begun a conversation about why he's resistant to reading novels and why I'm determined that it will do him good to read them. He offers a deal. He agrees to read my novel, which I say will take him 3 hours, if I will agree to go to a one-hour teaching session with a new local rabbi. 3-1. How could I not agree? We complete our tasks. I am struck by the rabbi's lack of interest in the views of the women gathered together to discuss the Torah reading. My friend has a long list of questions for me about my book. We talk about storytelling. He asks me why he should listen to stories from people he knows nothing about. Who are they to tell these stories, and what are they trying to say in them? Isn't it better to hear stories from the sages, the people whose spiritual goodness has been proven? After all, he says, the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, used stories to move the spirit in those whom he thought spiritually dormant. He tells me a story about Reb Zusha from Anipol, who lay on his deathbed surrounded by his students and his disciples. He was crying and nobody could comfort him, and a student asks the Rebbe, "Why do you cry? You were almost as wise as Moses and as kind as Abraham." And Reb Zusha answered, "When I pass from this world and appear before the heavenly tribunal, they won't ask me, 'Zusha, why weren't you as wise as Moses or as kind as Abraham?' Rather, they will ask me, 'Zusha, why weren't you Zusha? Why didn't I fulfil my potential? Why didn't I follow the path that could have been mine? So like the woodcutter's tale, this story tells us how to live, but on the one hand, we're urged not to reach too far and too high, not to expect too much. On the other hand, we're told to be the best one can be. Which advice do we choose? Is there one rule for a simple village woodcutter and another for a distinguished rabbi? Does choosing between them depend on the time and place you find yourself? What century it is? How easy it is for you to act on your desires? The threat of death hangs over all these stories, making the choices both poignant and dangerous. And if my friend prefers to hear stories from people whose spiritual goodness has been proven, what might he make of a writer who wishes to make art out of evil? I went into labour with my first daughter at the age of just 21. Packing my bag for the hospital, I included the usual things, as well as the draft of my honours thesis in microbiology. I thought I might be able to write between the contractions. And then, when the baby had come, between the feeds. Little did I know. But after the birth, my friend gave me a lifelong cherished gift. They were short stories. She explained that as a single mother of a seven-year-old, she'd noticed that short stories were all you ever got a chance to finish. These were the work of American writer Grace Paley. The collection was called The Little Disturbances of Man, and when I read it, I heard a voice that resonated within me, making me laugh and cry, and they seemed full of practical wisdom. The one called Goodbye and Good Luck is still my favourite. It's the first story she ever wrote. It's just marvellous. At the age of 34, it was 1956, and in it, an ageing woman reminisces fondly about her youth and the love of her life, who was a not always favourite actor in the Yiddish theatre. It's a story that we expect will end badly for her, but instead it moves to an unexpectedly blissful conclusion. I won't tell you how it ends, but I'll tell you how it begins. This is how it begins. "I was popular in certain circles," says Aunt Rose. "I wasn't no thinner then, only more stationary in the flesh. In time to come, Lily, don't be surprised. Change is a fact of God. From this no one is excused. Only a person like your mama stands on one foot. She don't notice how big her behind is getting and sings in the canary's ear for 30 years. Who's listening? Papa's in the shop? You and Seymour thinking about yourself? So she waits in a spotless kitchen for a kind word and she thinks, poor Rosie. Poor Rosie? If there was more life in my little sister, she would know my heart is a regular collage of feelings and there is such information between my corset and me that her whole married life is a kindergarten." I really want to read you the whole story, but it's so lovely, so full of hope and so full of grace. As American novelist and critic Joyce Carol Oates has said, how aptly named Grace Paley, for grace is perhaps the most accurate, if somewhat poetic, term to employ in speaking of this gifted writer. Grace Paley has been called a lyricist of the domestic life, writing of men and women, of children and parents, and of politics of the kind that Overland has been concerned with since its inception. When asked why she wrote relatively little, she said, "For me, there is a lot of time between knowing and telling." And when asked why she didn't attempt longer, more ambitious and technically challenging fiction, she replied, "Art is too long and life is too short. There's a lot more to do in life than just writing." "I was a woman," she explained, "writing at the early moment when small drops of worried resentment and noble rage were secretly slowly building into the second wave of the women's movement. I didn't know my small drop presence or usefulness in this accumulation." Grace Paley was 78 when I finally met her in New York at the French Roast, a coffee shop on the corner of 11th Street and 6th Avenue in 2001. It was January 2001. She was tiny and I towered over her to kiss her. Hello. Later she'd tell me about a friend of hers who died. "Not like me," she said. "My friend was petite." "And you're not?" I asked, laughing. "Petite in the garment industry, but not in real life," she said. "I'm just short and fat." We sat in the corner of a cafe eating salad and drinking coffee and talking about the terrible new president, the American coup, she called it, and the Russians, the short stories of Isaac Babel, our daughters, her grandchildren, adoption, stories of women who had given up their babies, and her trip to Arizona to an Indian reservation for a writer's workshop. She asked me to walk with her. She said she needed to do some shopping and she offered to show me her neighbourhood. "You know something about life," she said as we stood up from the table. "Tell me," I said. "When you're 78 and you get up from sitting at a table for a long time, your joints hurt." The reason why we couldn't meet at her house, she said, was that her daughter Nora was not feeling well and had flown in from Vermont for a rest. Nora made her mother promise that she could have the house to herself. "How old is your daughter?" I asked. "She's a middle-aged woman. If she were younger, I'd know more how to handle her." She said her kids resented her sociability when they were growing up. The numbers of people dropping by the house all the time bothered them, and now she thought maybe she overdid it. We walked past her house on 11th Street and she pointed out the landmarks, the church, which was now a library, and the women's prison, which was now a courtyard. "Is that where you were kept when you got arrested?" I asked, because she wrote a story about her character Faith, who had been arrested, like Grace Paley had been arrested once, at a demonstration. And the cell in the story is full of black women who are in for drugs or violence or prostitution. And when Faith, the character, explains why she's there because she's been at a demonstration, I seem to remember one of them shouting at the guards, "Get this housewife out of here!" We walked to a hardware store to find some handles for an old chest of drawers. And I asked as we walked along the street, "How is it when your friends die?" "Terrible," she said, "and they go in batches." We talked about the merits of having younger or older husbands. She said that friends who have married younger men are always concerned that their husbands will leave them, especially as they get older. "They always think it's the age," says Grace, "but it could be other things." "I like my old man." She stops for a moment and smiled to me as she talked of her husband Robert, who at 82 had started a new publishing venture with her in order to publish books that lots of publishers have rejected. "I like my old man, but I wouldn't want to be a younger woman married to an old man." She kept pausing in the street to tell me things. "I had a breast cancer last year. I had one breast removed, but I'm fine now. I'm good," she said. As we parted, we saw a professional dog walker with five charges. He tied them to a fire hydrant and went into a shop. They all sniffed each other's hindquarters and pissed on the hydrant, and they looked just like a cartoon from the New Yorker magazine. She pointed out the best way for me to get back to where I was staying, and we kissed and parted. She walked slowly back to 11th Street, her bushy grey hair blowing in the February wind. And as I watched her walking away, I thought I could have been in a story by Grace Paley, because in many of them, the women simply go for long walks and talk. That day, I had been given words of wisdom. A door had opened into her life and closed again as she walked into the day. Art not only imitates life, but life imitates art. Perhaps we not only learn about life from stories, perhaps we make our lives through the stories we tell ourselves about the things that happen to us. Grace Paley died a few months ago at the age of 84. Jess Roe wrote one of her obituaries. Like all the greatest masters of the short story, Chekhov, Hemingway, Sholem Aleichem, Raymond Carver, Amy Hempel, Paley had an uncanny genius for containing a world within a sentence. Her stories are often described as having a spontaneous performative quality, like dramatic monologues, but this is a carefully cultivated illusion. Her language mimics colloquial speech, but pares it down to nubbins of almost Beckett-like brevity. Somehow, I can't see William Gass's The Tunnel on a treasured list of books belonging to anyone I know. Actually, I don't even know anyone who remembers it. But I do know those to which I will return, those ideas, those books, those stories, for the feel and comfort of a wise heart. It won't be the books that play with language constructs, but those that give expression to the inner worlds we carry around inside our heads, that invite us to say, "Suppose it were me." I think we read to find out what the world is like, to experience lots of lives, not just the one we live. If it is true that our lives are chaotic and we crave a shape, stories might be shapes that we put on experience, containing all the wisdom in the world. We can even choose what kind of wisdom suits us. When people get old, Grace told the Paris Review in 1994, they seem wise, but it's only because they've got a little more experience, that's all. I'm not so wise. Two things happen when you get older. You have more experience, so you either seem wiser, or you get totally foolish. These are the only two options. You choose one, probably the wrong one. Grace Paley was petite in the garment industry, but not in real life. In reality, she was a giant. I can't walk with her in Greenwich Village in New York anymore, but I can open her books and feel her there again, her hand on my hand, her smile across the table, her voice, or a voice like her, saying, as she does in the opening line of one of her stories, "There were two husbands disappointed by eggs." How could you do anything but turn the page and see what happens next? Thank you.
The book shows Ramona Cavall speaking last month in Melbourne. You can find the text of her lecture, In Praise of the Common Reader, in the latest edition of the literary cultural magazine Overland. It's edition number 189. And if you want to listen again or to share Ramona's lecture with a friend, you can download the audio from the Bookshow website at abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. If you'd like to comment on Ramona's lecture, then click the Have Your Say button on our website to send us a message. We'll make sure that what you have to say gets passed on to Ramona. If it's a bouquet, we'll even interrupt her holidays. The brickbats can wait until she comes back to work. Not that I think there'll be any of those. You're with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Peter Mayer, standing in for Ramona until next Friday, which will officially mark the end of The Book Show's broadcast year. Although, don't fear, we've got plenty of great listening for you in our summer series through Christmas and January. If you're a regular Book Show listener, then you'll know what we've been reading lately. But what have you been reading, and what are you going to read over the summer?
I'm Amelia, and I really enjoyed reading Everything is Illuminated by Jonathan Safran Foer. I found it just a really, really beautiful book to read. Everything is written in a way that brings all the characters to life, and I was really laughing for the first half of the book and really, really sad towards the end. And as soon as I finished the last page, I was at a cafe, I had to go back and start reading the first page again because I was already missing the characters. I don't have anything lined up for the summer yet, but I'll be keeping my eye out.
My name's Nick. The most recent book I read was an old one, a Morton Thompson, called The Cry and the Covenant. And I thought it was a beautiful tale. It was sort of touching, as well as having an important story, but it was a touching tale. And the next book I'm about to, well, I've just started reading, is also an old one called Civilization and Its Discontents by Sigmund Freud.
Freud, no less. I think I'll opt for something a bit lighter for my summer reading. We'll bring you more book tips from the streets and cafes next week on The Book Show on ABC Radio National. That's it for The Book Show for today and for this week. Thanks to the team, Michael Shirriffs, Sarah Lestrange, Zulfika Abani, Catherine Frame, and technical producer Martin Lawrence. I'm Peter Mayers, and I'll look forward to the pleasure of your company again next week on The Book Show. On Monday, my guest will be Australian writer Matthew Condon, talking about his new novel, The Trout Opera, a sprawling tale set on the snowy river at Dalgetty, once surveyed as a potential site for Australia's capital. It's a great novel. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. A couple of hundred more pages to go over the weekend. So I'm very much looking forward to speaking to the author, Matthew Condon. That's The Book Show on Monday morning after the 10 o'clock news on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.